coolest library I've been to. So we just wanted to have a little fun. Anybody have a cool library they want to share? No.
Now they should be able to hear us online.
Oh, they weren't hearing us? Oh.
No worries. Okay, so just to, as kind of a high level overview and kind of tying into some of the themes that have been coming up, you know, throughout the conference, you know, openness as a sort of a concept is a really heavy focus in lots of different areas of higher education, research, publishing. I think generally, you know, all of us would agree that there's, you know, that the democratization of information and that exposing data and resources and helping to like build inclusivity is something that's going to benefit all of us. So a lot of, you know, we have all these different areas. There's open science, open data, open pedagogy, open access publishing. You know, we're all here as part of an open source software conference. And all of those different sort of conceptual areas have led to a lot of work and a lot of effort in really articulating like values and standards that are associated with all of those areas. How do we define these concepts? And then how do we integrate them into what we've already been doing? So as we sort of transition from these more closed systems and architectures and business models, we're in this really interesting kind of transitional space where we're moving towards more open ecosystems, but we still all have to integrate and leverage and bring along all of that older ways of doing things, those commercial systems, those more closed areas. So some of the things that, you know, challenges that we're having to think about in all of these areas are, you know, how do we integrate open source resources with commercial platforms? How do we expose open educational resources? How do we define them? How do we differentiate open resources from other resources? And then for the purposes of today's session, we'll be talking about how we actually can integrate and provide seamless access to licensed content and open content now that there's such a prevalence of open access materials. So we'll talk about these issues primarily around the areas of open educational resources and open access materials. But again, with this in mind, that there's this whole other ecosystem of openness that's going on in many other areas of scholarship. So before we get started, it's probably helpful to just define a little bit of, you know, what open access means, what open educational resources mean. Hopefully this isn't like super review for everyone, but it may be. So both open educational resources and open access are generally free materials. They're a little bit different, though, in the sense that open educational resources are very specific in these types of access and permissions that they have. They're called the five R's, and those five R's we'll talk about in just a moment, but they're perpetual and irrevocable ways that you can access and modify these materials. Open access materials are slightly different. Some of them might require a login. Some of them might allow some of those five R's, but not necessarily all of them. So, you know, all open educational resources are open access, but not all open access materials are educational resources. So it's important to kind of have that differentiation. And when we talk about the five R's of open educational resources, what those mean are the ability to retain, so to keep and have a copy of that resource forever, to be able to reuse it in a variety of ways, you know, to republish it, to be able to revise it, to edit it, adapt it, modify it, to mix different open educational resources together to create something novel, and then finally to redistribute them, you know, publish in a course or publish on your website or, you know, share it however you'd like. And with OERs, if you can't do all five of those things, it's not an open educational resource. So it's very specific. They're defined very particularly, and it's a very broadly permissible range of usage that you can have with those objects. Open educational resources also typically have an attribution statement. It's kind of similar to like a citation. You give credit to the original author, the title, and the links to the different licenses that would be involved to use that material. So why are open access and open educational resources important? Why are we focusing on them so much more? Well, that increased visibility, increased citations, the ability to expose materials creates a broader readership for those things and more possibilities for collaboration between researchers. There's also a real focus on increasing equity of access to materials for people in developing nations, people in smaller, less funded institutions. So, and faculty are increasingly advocating for publishing under open access models as well. Institutions and universities will also often have sort of textbook initiatives to try to drive down the costs of textbook and course materials. So there are a lot of forces kind of convening to increase the amount of publishing that occurs under these models. And when we think about open access itself, there are also different types of open access. So typically they're defined kind of by two different criteria. One is whether or not there's a fee associated with the publishing. Those fees are usually called article processing charges or APCs. You'll hear them referred to. They're sometimes have to be covered by the authors directly. Sometimes the institution will cover them either directly or through centrally funded deals with publishers. Sometimes they're covered by membership fees in, you know, scholarly societies. There's a whole variety of different ways that those APCs can be covered. And then the second main criteria of defining which type of open access you're looking at is where that material is originally published. Like, does it start out open access by being published in an open access repository or journal? Or does it originate in a subscription database and then become open access later through various avenues? And then there's more types of open access as well. Bronze refers to, you know, being free to read or free open access right now, but potentially without specific reuse guidelines, so that perpetual and irrevocable nature isn't necessarily specified. Yellow can refer to journals that publish a mix of open access and subscription materials. There's black open access, which is like unauthorized and illegal sharing on certain networks that exist. But at this point, most institutions are creating guidelines and goals about how much of each type of open access they want their institution's publications to conform to. And the cool and interesting thing about all this is that it's still in flux and being kind of developed and evolving as more and more open access publishing occurs. But looking at it really from all angles, open access publishing is growing across all types of open access. Here we can see the University of Reading. I think it's pronounced Reading. They have, over the past number of years, you can see that most types of open access materials being published is increasing. This graph looks at APAC countries, and you can see all the various types of open access increasing across entire geographic areas, and even across, you know, individual societies or publications. Like, this is from the American Chemical Society. So we can see in this graph, you know, open access is well represented in almost all areas of the globe. And then over the past 3 years, you see an increase across not only the number of authors that are publishing via open access models, but the number of articles that are being produced open access and the number of downloads that are occurring on open access materials. So there are a number of federal and international policy shifts that also have been accelerating open access adoption. You know, the concept of open access goes back as far as the early 90s when, you know, physicists started self-archiving their work in archive databases. But more recently, there have been a number of federal mandates and institutional mandates kind of requiring, for instance, in 2018, Plan S was a really big one. And then in 2022, the White House Office of Science and Technology plan, which mandated that federally funded research must be publicly accessible by the end of this year. The National Institute of Health in 2025 also mandated that their NIH funded research be open access. So really all of this, these mandates just demonstrate this focus on open access as a concept and a willingness of institutions and governments to really back those initiatives with formal policy. And early on, a lot of the work within libraries for open access was driven by the Dutch libraries and some Eastern European organizations. But now the US is pretty fully on board and following suit. So all of those federal and international mandates didn't just apply to published articles. They also worked to really establish guidelines and best practices for other types of research. So part of that OTSP memo also specified guidelines for metadata and established the FAIR principles for data and digital objects. The FAIR principles are really interesting. You could do a whole session on them. Really, their main focus was on the application of unique identifiers to help make data and digital objects more accessible and machine readable and human readable. So applying things like ORCID IDs and DOIs to documents, unique identifiers. And it really was intended to make all aspects of research more standardized and accessible. So on an institutional level, in order to sort of answer these goals, these institutional goals to produce more open access materials, there really was a recognition that institutions needed to start working in a completely different way with publishers in order to help like bridge that transition from subscription model to an open access model. So that's where transformative agreements come in. There are many, many kinds of transformative agreements. They also can be called read and publish agreements. And they basically combine the more traditional, read or subscription access to database fees with fees for covering the article processing charges for open access articles. So they're this sort of hybrid model. They vary really widely from publisher to publisher, from institution to institution. You could really do a deep dive on transformative agreements, but it's a relatively new way of interacting with publishers to help guide these open access publishing goals. So a little bit about some of the challenges that are involved in this new transitional world. As federal mandates do push for more immediate open access, there are copyright and licensing complexities that are emerging. Authors often sign over their rights to publishers, which can conflict with open access requirements, of course. Publishers, understandably worry about losing control and revenue. Congress is also involved in scrutinizing some of these policies to ensure that authors' rights are protected. And then even for institutions that have transitional agreements in place, that movement to open access really isn't linear. There's a lot of tension between this push for openness and the legacy systems of copyright control. And libraries are often kind of finding themselves caught in the middle of trying to support faculty, comply with these mandates, and then also negotiate for fair terms with publishers. There's also some growing concern that these article processing charge-based models might incentivize quantity over quality. So some publishers might prioritize revenue over rigor, and then equity is also a major issue. There are researchers from developing nations and underfunded institutions that may struggle to come up with those article processing fees in ways that other institutions just don't have to deal with. It's also very difficult for libraries. It's a whole additional burden of effort for libraries to be able to analyze and negotiate these agreements because there's so much variety in them. And then to be able to actually quantify the success of these transitional agreements once they're in place. Is it working? Is it cost effective? What sort of model do we need to move to in order to, continue on this process, this progress towards more open access publishing? And then just a few more quality and equity concerns. Again, these APC initiatives can sometimes create an influx of lower quality publications. There's a whole industry of predatory publishing where there are kind of these bogus journals with non-rigorous peer review testing that target authors directly. And that can really damage both author reputation and also just generally trust in the quality of research. And then the equity issues for underfunded researchers and institutions. An APC model tends to favor people that are later in their career, people that are tenure track. And we know that there are just certain types of people that have easier access to funding than others. So even though the output of research is more equitable under open access, there are inherent inequalities that still exist in access to the funding for that research. So it's just a whole additional layer that we need to kind of take into account and work on making better. AI throws a whole other kind of wrench into the situation. And in combination with that whole predatory publishing industry, there's just a large increase in the number of retractions. So there's sort of retractions are also going up as open access publishing does as well. So it's important for us to be able to expose when retractions take place and make sure that that's a highly visible part of the research process. So EBSCO's goal is really to provide researchers with the best access to research, whether that's open access or subscription content. We want to be able to make all of that material accessible side by side and also to be very, very simple for researchers to drill into open access materials alone without the subscription material and also have them side by side. We do a number of things to try to ensure the quality of the open access journals that we provide by using, leveraging top citation index that we know are well studied. And we also use, real live people, subject matter experts to monitor those predatory publishing lists and make sure that deceptive content is excluded from our sources. But overall, we really want to support our libraries. We recognize that seamless access really supports efforts on equity and inclusion. We want to help our customers align with those open science and public access mandates and also empower users with choice and transparency in their research process. So I will now turn it over to Andrew to talk in more specifics about the EBSCO ecosystem.
Thanks, Kathy. So I want to kind of talk about how EBSCO is dealing with all these challenges and also try to tie it back to Folio, which is why we're all here. So I want to talk about the EBSCO ecosystem. I think one of the important things is how we create integrations. So there's lots of different technologies and services that we're working on that address a number of these things. And we want those systems to all kind of interoperate with one another. And what we've been doing is trying to create hooks into Folio for these technologies and services. Also, I was having way too much fun with AI, and I was like, I need a good transition slide. And I didn't realize that the PowerPoint template that we all got already had a transition slide in it. So I was like, AI, create me a transition slide for this. So I always like to open with a joke, right? Because this is kind of ridiculous. But so this is what it came up with for me. So, So Kathy has been talking a lot about open educational resources, about open access materials, about predatory journals, and how we're addressing those from a pedagogic view. And I want to just talk about how we're actually implementing and dealing with some of this stuff. So in our user interface, in our knowledge base. In our knowledge base, we keep track of all of the world's databases and packages and titles of resources that libraries subscribe to. One of the things that we've recently done is we've created a resource within our knowledge base for open access and open educational resources. So we now have an open educational resource collection within our knowledge base, and you can enable that so that you can expose these OER collections to your patrons and make that a part of your a part of your collection. So we have, we've also created a user interface dedicated just for that. So if you want to be able to provide access to your faculty to explore these collections, we index something like 8 or 10 different open educational resource collections. We bring that all together. So it makes it very easy and convenient for you to get to that. So you can look up EBSCO Open Educational Resource Discovery, and you can find some information about that. But you can also add that to your existing EDS or whatever that you might be using for discovery. Kathy mentioned retractions, right? So we've been seeing with AI a dramatic increase in publications and content and citations. And so as we're starting to identify, maybe some should not have gone through the filters that create retractions. So this is a new feature that we just released into EDS. I would assume also in EBSCOhost as well, where we still have the content index, but we identify it as being a retraction. So you can see here that we've labeled that search result element as a retracted article. So that way you still have access to the citation. You can still access that the item, but we can identify for the user that that has actually been retracted. Also too, we don't have on the slide, but I might as well print it out as well. We just added a cool new feature that I really like. So you can see how some of the authors here, the search results, have a green quill icon. Sorry, I walked away from the microphone. And a green quill icon, and their names are in green. We've now created author pages. So if you attended any of Gloria and Alvaro's sessions yesterday, you would have learned all about the great work that we're doing around creating linked data graphs. And we've now integrated our linked data graph into EDS and EBSCOhost so that you can see author pages, and those author pages are enriched with different external content. We're always adding more as well. I think we're adding ORCID into that as well. And that content is also tied back into your folio instance, because we can take your folio records, convert them to BibFrame. Your metadata can all go into this. And it starts to, now we're finally starting to realize or recognize the value of open linked data. So that's one of our new features as well. So since it was on the slide, I might as well point that out. It's a cool new feature. Yep, and it's both on the detailed record view as well. So we talked about this, the EBSCO Discovery Open Educational Platform. So this is also available and allow your faculty to discover and explore the collection of open educational resources, so textbooks and other materials. Okay, so I want to talk about some of the integrations that we're doing with Folio as well, and how we're tying this all back together. So I want to start with what the EBSCO ecosystem. Oh no, my animation broke. Ignore that logo at the top there. It'll come back in later. So our core infrastructure at EBSCO, our knowledge base, which I just mentioned, Gobi, which is our book platform, and EBSCOnet, those technologies have been integrated. So when EBSCO got involved in the Folio project back in 2016, we identified that what we wanted to do is leverage the integrations that we have here. So we have an integration between our knowledge base and our book platform and our journal platform. So EBSCOnet is our journal serials, Gobi is our books. So if you use any of those for managing your acquisitions, when you purchase something or renew something, it automatically updates that in the knowledge base. That's really important, because it's a lot of work to buy something and then go and update a knowledge base afterwards, especially if we're buying a lot of individual titles, right? We want to take advantage of that automation. So what we wanted to do when we got involved with the Folio project in 2016 was extend that integration into Folio, and that's what we did. So as you order something from Gobi, from EBSCOnet, from anything through EBSCO. Actually, EBSCO's ordering processing platform, the whole behind the scenes technology that customers never interact with, we've integrated that into Folio so that as you order any of these things, even if you order a database from us, it will update all that information in Folio. So your purchase order records can automatically be created, all of the things that the purchase order app can then do, all tied in together. So we wanted to extend that level of integration into the ILS system. That was one of the reasons why we wanted to get involved with Folio, is to help create that level of integration. And then we have, of course, our discovery service. We have Panorama and Locate. So you've probably heard about those. If you attended Corey's session earlier, you learned all about Panorama and how we've integrated that in with Folio. Of course, our discovery service, Locate. And then we've created partnerships as well to help extend that. So there was a session yesterday, I think, on eReserve Plus. So that's a younger company that we partnered with to bring electronic reserves workflows to the Folio environment. They have a really fantastic platform for doing electronic reserves. When we created the partnership with them, I love these guys. They stopped everything that they were doing and they pivoted and they rebuilt their entire platform as an app in Folio. That app is, I think, now live or will be live in the next day or two. I think the goal was to have it launched for this WolfCon. So I think it's getting ready to be deployed right now. So if you use eReserve's product, you can have their app in Folio. And I think this is another major milestone in the development of Folio because up until now, all of the apps in Folio have been all open source and freely available. And this is the first time now we're seeing, other than EBSCO, a commercial vendor bring an app for their product into the Folio marketplace. So to me, this is a huge milestone in the evolution and the development of Folio, because now it's really truly turning into a marketplace where you'll be able to get additional apps, even commercial paid for apps to extend your Folio environment. And we also partnered with Open Athens as well to extend bringing in single sign-on authentication to the service. And so this is what we consider to be the EBSCO ecosystem, this colorful diagram here. I just want to put that up there to kind of explain what we're doing with EBSCO and making sure that all of our products are integrated in with Folio. The idea being that any library who adopts Folio, implements Folio, uses it, can have seamless access to EBSCO's products. So our discovery tool, our OPAC, our authentication tool, our analytics platform, electronic reserves, workflows, acquisitions, all of that is tied in with Folio. That's what we wanted to be able to make sure that Folio libraries had that capability. What's powering a lot of this is our knowledge base. So of course, that was the first thing that we integrated in with EBSCO was our knowledge base. Our knowledge base is updated on a daily basis. We have over 7,500 libraries around the world relying on our knowledge base to manage their holdings. It's the most comprehensive knowledge base in the industry because EBSCO works with so many different types of libraries around the world. So we track and collect information about published content and materials from all around the world to make sure that we are able to provide that as a service for all types of libraries, government libraries, special libraries, academics, publics, from all around the world. As Damien said earlier, in every country or in every continent except for Antarctica, we have customers who are relying on these services. All of our integrations are real-time API-driven integrations. So what's nice is as you make any changes to your profile in the knowledge base, all of our external tools are interacting with that data in real-time, including Folio. So Folio is up-to-date in real-time when you work with your electronic holdings. So our holdings are API-driven. Our knowledge base has read and write APIs that feed into Folio, and it also connects in with Full Text Finder, which is our link resolver, and EDS, and all those other products. Of course, Gobi has APIs that plug right into Folio. And if you attended the session, I think it was yesterday, about the Gobi, the eventual replacement of Gobi, which is now being called Mosaic. Mosaic is in the process of being integrated in with Folio right now. Mosaic was built from the ground up, so very modern. Of course, also very API driven and connecting into Folio so that you can do all sorts of great work with your acquisitions workflow. So we're trying to enrich and enhance the acquisitions workflow in Folio as well through EBSCO's platforms. And as well too, Counter. So we have a platform called Usage Consolidation where you can load your Counter reports in. I know the Folio community has built the eUsage app. What we did is we built our usage consolidation service directly into eHoldings. So as you're working with any of your holdings, you can view the Counter data right there within the eHoldings interface. So as you're working with your packages, your titles, you can get the Counter data right there with you. Because it's in EBSCO's usage consolidation data warehouse, that's integrated in with Folio, but it's also integrated with other things, and it has its own report. So usage consolidation has its own reporting interface, but it's also feeding data into Panorama. So you can use Panorama and you can get analytics around your Counter data. You can get the raw data right from Folio interface. So as you're working with your packages and your collections. So again, we wanted to try and see how can EBSCO enrich some of the different apps and workflows that Folio is providing you. And so through all of these different APIs and services that we provide, we're trying to help our customers provide a better experience within Folio. We have an API called Holdings IQ. I'm going to go through this very quickly. And the idea is that a lot of the data would have to be manually updated. There was a session, I think, from it might have been Lehigh yesterday, or maybe some of the German libraries who were talking about using GoKB, and a lot of the manual update process that has to happen, right? Creating the data, updating the data manually. What we wanted to try and do is automate as much of that as possible. And so through our Holdings IQ service, it's both a read and write API. We provide access to the APIs as well. So if you have an external tool, or you want to write scripts, or if you have any of your own scripts that interact with Folio APIs, and you want to also do some electronic resource management workflows, you can build scripts to our knowledge base API, which is called Holdings IQ. But that's how we've built that integration in with the eHoldings app. So eHoldings can update your EBSCO's knowledge base profile. You can activate packages and titles. You can manipulate all of that. It then updates all the discovery tool and the link resolver and the A to Z list and everything all in real time. And so we've been able to really greatly streamline a lot of the electronic resource management through there. And then, of course, we've integrated the counter data, so you have access to all of that data all in real time. We've also been looking at how do we improve access to metadata and integration of metadata. We've launched a product called Bibliograph, which is our linked data graph. And you probably heard, again, going back to Gloria and Alvaro's sessions yesterday, they talked a lot about the work that we're doing around linked data and building graph networks and being able to share metadata. EBSCO Mosaic. EBSCO's Mosaic, I put it in Mosaic, originally had Gobi, so we all know it as Gobi. Gobi, Mosaic, they have a team of catalogers on staff. They are originally cataloging newly published books. I actually heard that actually a lot of the OCLC WorldCat records originate at Gobi, because the very first library to buy a brand new book, they might get it from Gobi. Gobi catalogs it, sends the MARC record over, they feed it into WorldCat. And actually, there's all these lawsuits now from OCLC about how, oh, this is our data. But actually, I've been learning that EBSCO is actually the one who's creating a lot of those new MARC records. We are sitting on, you know, all of the newly published content. We have MARC records there that we're feeding to our customers. A lot of libraries are using OCLC's connection for cataloging. And then I sat in on the Blue Core presentation, which I thought was really exciting. I was like, hey, wouldn't that be cool if we could maybe create a connector? Maybe Stanford's going to do that for Blue Core into Folio. That would be really cool, right? And we're doing some amazing work with the Library of Congress to make sure that their new linked data records are going to be openly available and integrated in with Folio. And we have a Z3950 connector for anybody who likes to do 1980s cataloging. You have access to that. So there's a lot of work here, but I think there's also a ton of new functionality that's coming as well. And this is, an area of significant improvement. With a lot of new things coming. And then, of course, also a lot of libraries are using open source catalogs. ViewFind, Blacklight, EBSCO provides our proprietary OPAC called Locate, and those are all integrated in with Folio's inventory. Folio's inventory actually has an Elasticsearch index built into it. So Locate actually uses that Elasticsearch index that's real time in the Folio inventory app. But I know, like ViewFind and Blacklight, they're harvesting data out of the Folio inventory through OAI PMH. The Folio inventory app has a OAI PMH endpoint. So just yet another API for working with data. Of course, it has its own API, so we're able to pull data in, as we just talked about. But I've heard about libraries, special collections libraries, doing things with archive space and pushing MARC records from archive space into the Folio inventory and doing work like that. And some other interactions for spine level printing and other things that external tools are utilizing. So there's a lot of integrations there that we're able to help enrich. I was hoping to have some really cool examples to share with you about integration with student information systems, but all of my customers, everybody's like, oh, I don't know. It's that guy over there. He has all the, nobody really had it all defined. But a lot of our Folio libraries are interacting with their student information system. I know we were working just recently with Columbia University as they were going live, and they did a whole bunch of really cool interactions with Workday is their primary financial system, but they actually have several others as well that they created integrations with. So thankfully, just to Folio's APIs, they were just able to build integrations with using Folio APIs. So nothing really special there. We talked about eReserve Plus. I'm not going to go into this because they had a whole session on it yesterday. If you want to learn more, that's recorded. But this, I just wanted to show you this because I think this is just so cool. Finally see like a commercial company build their own app in Folio. So if you haven't seen it yet, I don't think it's on Snapshot or in a publicly accessible place, but so that's why I put the screenshot up here because I wanted to show you. I thought this was really cool. They've created their own app and they've rebuilt their entire software as an app in Folio. And so that's now available, but it does require a subscription to their service. Another one that we've been dealing a lot with and kind of ties back to what Kathy was talking about earlier is with analytics. So there's been a lot of presentations on reporting at this conference. So a lot of libraries are using MetaDB and LDLite. Of course, all of the EBSCO customers get access to Panorama. And so we have a lot of integrations with analytics, but I wanted to talk about, are there other ideas for how we could do reporting and analytics and analysis using other tools? And just to talk a little bit about Panorama. So Panorama is a built on Tableau. So what we've done is we've created a feed from Folio into AWS, into their data cloud, into Snowflake. So any tech geeks out there might know what that is. And then Snowflake feeds all of the data right into Tableau. And so we've actually talked about being able to make that Snowflake data set available to our customers as well. But so what we've been able to do is take all of the data out of Folio and create some really awesome and highly useful analytics and charts and dashboards and graphs. We just launched, tying back into what Kathy was talking about, read and publish. So one of the other things that we wanted to help our customers with is not only get access to all their Folio data, but we've also tied into some other data sets, both open published data sets, as well as some commercial data sets that we've licensed to be able to create read and publish dashboards. So if you're thinking about going to read and publish, our read and publish dashboards can help you better analyze the impact that your read and publish agreements are making. So what we've done is we've done two dashboards here. We have the agreements dashboard, and that looks at your existing agreements and tracks how they're being utilized and how your APCs are being spent. And then also we have a publisher's dashboard. So it's looking at everything that your institution is publishing and looking at the cost of those publishers that you have and being able to see if there's any potentially new read and publish agreements that would be valuable for you, or maybe renegotiating some of your agreements, maybe some of the capacities or the amount of APCs that are included in your agreements. Maybe you want to expand on them. Maybe you want to shrink it. Maybe you want to add new ones. So we've added that into Panorama. And for all of the EBSCO Folio libraries, they get access to Panorama. So this is a new feature that we just rolled out. I wanted to end with, I went through that super quick because I actually have to go to the airport. I apologize for my poor logistics and planning. But I wanted to end on something a little bit more thought-provoking. So this is an idea of how is the Folio community bridging access to institutional repositories? This is something that I hear all the time. And I know there's been a lot of interest in integrations with things like DSpace and Simvera and Haiku and Islandora. If anybody was here for the very first WolfCon at Texas A&M, we had a pilot, a partner of EBSCO's. We created an app. It no longer exists. We've thrown it away with a digital preservation company. The idea being that you could upload your collections through Folio and deposit it into a digital preservation system, and you could do some cataloging. I think the timing was just a little off because we didn't even have like circulation at the time, but we had this cool digital preservation app. Maybe it's time to revisit that. Is there interest in having digital preservation and institutional repository cataloging built in as yet another app in Folio and expanding the capacity of Folio? This is something that I'm personally really, really interested in, and I would love to see something happening in that area. But I wanted to end in a question to you all. What sort of things, we talked a lot about expanding on Folio. We talked a lot about creating additional capacities and integrations with other services and data sets and how we can leverage all that data that's out there and expand on Folio. If you want to, I did a live poll. I just, like, as Kathy said, it's the last session or one of the last sessions on a Friday, trying to just make this a little bit more fun. If you scan that QR code, it will give you a place where you can type in ideas that you have, and then we can take a look and maybe have some conversation. So I'll let you think about that. We've got about 5-7 minutes left. But if you have questions or comments, or you want to fill out the poll, we'll take a look. I don't see anybody scanning the QR code, so maybe that was a bad idea. Yeah. Go ahead. Oh, microphone. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So about open access. Hold on.
There we go. So I was thinking about open access, and I was thinking about the EDS index. So when you go to turn on a database in the index, and there's not really any information, like if you want to find out if that index is open access or even partially open access, you have to go into a spreadsheet essentially on the support site. So that's like one integration. Like I would love to see more information at the point of need about what is in the index, particularly because open access has some pretty big linking implications. So what kind of integrations between HLM holdings management, the index, and open access have you been exploring?
Well, we were hoping that you would tell us some ideas. we've been grappling with that challenge for a long time, because I think defining the problem is there are packages that are mixed, a lot of packages that are mixed, and it might come down to a specific journal or even a specific article within a journal, and getting the data correct and accurate is a massive, massive undertaking and challenge, something that we just have not been able to accomplish yet. But it's definitely something that I think is very important, especially every year. It's just more and more access is through open access or different models, right? As we just, I didn't even know, I learned today that there's a thing called Black, right? So how do we label these things? How do we identify them? Maybe at the database level, maybe at the package level, maybe at the title level, maybe at the article level. How do we track that and manage that and make sure that it's accurate and up to date is a huge undertaking. And so something that we're trying to figure out. I don't have an answer for you, but yeah, it's definitely something that needs to happen. It's just the how. Yeah. So another question?
Well, I think that was a better version of my question, which is talk about holdings and OA. Because yeah, it's
right.
You're not holding OA, you're not subscribing to, or maybe you're subscribing from a traditional publisher or a traditional source, but maybe you're not.
Yeah.
So how do those, and when you're doing things like counter, does that still work for OA content? And how does that reflect? Just kind of general questions that right now we seem to be under-equipped or trying to use an old model in managing resources, which are now predominantly open access.
Yeah.
At least at a global scale.
Yeah. I don't know if you want to add, but yeah, there's not much more that I can say than what I've already said. It's a huge, huge undertaking and a huge shift from our kind of a little bit older model of how our knowledge base works to today's model. Thinking about managing and tracking all the different variations of open access and linking, you're absolutely right. We integrate with third parties that kind of do a better job of some of that linking, like things like Unpaywall, that say, hey, there's an open access version of this commercial product that you might be able to access. So we've partnered with some of those organizations to allow you, if you want to use that model. Some libraries want their user to use the open access model. Some don't. I pay for this thing. I want my usage. Don't use the open access version. Some libraries want to use the preprint or the open access because it's free and things like that. So, and then, you know, authentication and linking and all of that. It's I wish I had a better answer, but it's definitely a huge project that EBSCO needs to tackle. Yeah. There was another question over here or over here. Anybody else? Question or comments? Anything online?
QR code doesn't work, but...
No, the QR doesn't code. What doesn't work?
But I just told them...
Yeah, just put it in chat.
In the UI? Oh, thank you. So you showed there's an OER collection in EDS. Is there... How does open access manifest itself? Is there also an open access collection, or is that more difficult to get your arms around?
No, there's several open access collections that are in there. And so I think that's what we're talking about, is it's not easily identifiable and managed through a spreadsheet. So we have it all documented in a spreadsheet, and you can go and find the ones that are relevant for you and then go and turn them on. And so I think the question was, is why do I have to go into a spreadsheet when it should just be right in the interface? And that's a great question. It's just something that we haven't been able to tackle yet.
There is also there is an open access filter and an open educational resource filter that you can use in the regular EDS interface. That EDS open education resource is kind of more of like a separate collection almost that can be live aside from your normal EDS access.
I would just have to say, with the budget pressures that we're all facing, relying or leveraging open access resources, which may be high quality, as high quality, or in some cases higher quality, seems like it's more important than ever.
Yeah. And you say that now, but like, you know, 10 years ago, that would have been the comment in Europe, right? Where a lot of they're kind of ahead of the times compared to the US. So our European colleagues have been having this conversation for a long time. Yeah. Okay. Well, I've got to run to the airport. So thank you. That'll be the end. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for picking us over the Library of Congress's presentation. We appreciate it.
Like the small local band.
Right, exactly.
When Taylor Swift is in.
Yes. Who wants Taylor Swift when you can hang out with us?